Good evening. One quick announcement. If you are interested and free on Saturday, we have a one-day Zazenkai. It's a day of meditation that starts at 5 a.m. and goes to 5 p.m. It's quite an adventure. I recommend it. It is you can sign up on the website, and the sign-up closes tomorrow evening. So that's it.
Please make Gasho. May the sacred presence of the one who said he would abide in his teaching be our guide. May we follow his glorious example and tread with unfaltering step through this noble path until we too shall attain enlightenment. All Buddhas, both space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Welcome, everybody. We are in week six, I believe, of our study of the Bodhisattva precepts. So, at the beginning of this series, I mentioned how failure is kind of woven into all of these precepts and our work with these precepts. We come up to failure a lot, and we draw attention to that failure. And so I'm interested how you've been working with these precepts and you've gone about your lives, and I'm interested in about that failure. I'm interested in failure in throughout your work week, right? So I'm also interested in success, but I'm much more interested in failure. So if anybody would like to share any of their failures publicly, that would be really informative. Thank you. And exciting.
This is Jen. So I'm not sure I would characterize this as a failure, but I wonder.
Let me be the judge of
That's kind of a relief to hear. Okay.
that.
Taking refuge in Buddha. I have been thinking of taking refuge in Buddha as like I'm irritated with my kids and I go and I sit and I meditate and I touch the peace inside of me. And then sometimes, I'm struggling and I'm taking refuge in Netflix and I'm like, I'm feeling bad and I don't have the time or the energy to process this. And I'm just going to go and watch a movie. And like, is that a fail?
Well, I mean, is it not about intention? I think Netflix is okay, isn't it? I mean, does it feel like a fail? I mean, I think I would ask, like, what is the intention there? I mean, sometimes I think we have to be kind to ourselves too, you know? Sometimes a little break, just a little bit of stepping away. I think that's going to be okay. I mean, it might, I'm so maybe I'm a poor practitioner, I don't know, but I just feel like I feel like there's a lot like a lack of kindness sometimes to ourselves, you know?
I mean, I do too. That's partly why I make the decision, right?
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm
Yeah.
tired. I want to check out,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And also, I wonder about that. Is that ultimately a habit pattern that in the long term is not helping alleviate my suffering?
It could be, but okay, so are you do you feel like you're a worse mother after a few minutes of Netflix.
Maybe if I get interrupted. Highly likely if I get
Okay.
interrupted.
Yeah.
Also be a little angry if I'm interrupted from trying to really like have a little time to turn my focus inward too.
Yeah. I think you're doing great.
I
I
thought
mean,
you were gonna
yeah.
tell me like a
No.
definitive answer
No,
here.
I'm sorry. I can't do
Like
that. It could be me on that, yeah,
a
but I can't do that. I don't have a percentage. I say kindness goes a long way, and kindness to yourself. I think we're all. I think sometimes it's hard for us to be kind to ourselves.
Hi, it's Reggie. I've got a couple failures and also a success. So full story. A couple things I've been noticing and just keeping a curious eye on are right speech, which isn't exactly a precept, but falls into precept category. There's several precepts that it could be tied to. And another one is comparing, and in particular, those in collaboration. So those, I've just been watching those and noticing how those arise in me lately. And there's been some misses. And the success is that, like, it's okay. Like, I'm watching them and noticing them. And so I'm not blaming myself or others, even when I'm noticing a comparison there. So that feels pretty, like, accurate. Like, okay, something's working, that I can notice these fails and be like, that was a miss, and not get caught in it.
Thank you. Thank you for giving a great example of kindness. That's awesome. Thank you. Anybody else with anything to share?
This is Andy. I was thinking of the multiple situations in my life in which there's a difficult conversation that you know you have to have with skillful means, but applying skillful means means picking the right words in the right time. And I find myself waffling between pushing off the time and not having the words, and therefore not doing that. When, you know, so when do you cross the line and have the bravery to have the conversation? It's a very difficult thing. And sometimes that can feel like failure to, and I wasn't sure which precept to go with here, but embrace all things and conditions is one that comes to mind. And that sometimes I feel like I'm avoiding things too much because I'm repelled to that. It's a dislike. So there's a pushing away, which I know is not, and instead of embracing that particular condition, even though it's not a condition I like.
Yeah.
And this is a very difficult tension that it can exist, and it can, you have doubts, and I feel like I'm failing sometimes.
Yeah.
I also have then compassion with myself because it's really hard. So I think I'll pick that one.
Boy, that rings true for me, that kind of tension. So I have, I notice in myself an avoidance, you know? And so when I'm in a situation like that and I can sense the avoidance, like I'm looking for that because I notice it in myself. That's when I know I need to like step forward, you know, when I notice the avoidance. Like, and sometimes that is like, sometimes it's a difficult conversation, right? And the avoidance is natural because I don't want to hurt somebody. I don't want to be clumsy in my speech, but sometimes I got to be clumsy with the speech, you know? Sometimes it's going to come out clumsy. I don't know. I look out for the avoidance, and then if I see that in myself, I want to push myself forward, you know? Because for me, that's just like a pattern. So I'm sorry, I haven't got an easy answer for that. I struggle with that also.
There is. I'm just saying that it's a point of this tension, even between a couple. Like when you say, well, I'm going to embrace this thing and do this, but then you run right into do not kill, cultivate encourage, obviously, literally, but am I killing somehow by saying this? So I find myself vacillating between some precepts sometimes, and it's hard to know where that boundary is.
Acting from a place of compassion is a good place to start, you know? Is that, what's the reason behind it, you know? Like, is it a compassionate act in it, like in its nugget, in the germ of it? Is it like a compassionate act? You know, that could be helpful. Good luck. Okay, thank you. So, I want to introduce a precept to you. And I haven't found it. Hold on a second. Okay. Do not dwell on past mistakes. Create wisdom from ignorance. In the realm of the flawless Dharma, not expanding upon error is the precept of not dwelling on past mistakes. In the Buddha Dharma, there is one path, one Dharma, one realization, one practice. Do not engage in fault finding. Do not condone haphazard talk.
So, a mistake in the dictionary is error in judgment is the definition, or one of the main definitions. So, when I think of mistakes, I think of a few different things, but I did think of this little story that stuck with me a long time ago about two carpenters. And a carpenter asked another carpenter, like, hey, what's the difference between a carpenter and a master carpenter? And the answer is a master carpenter knows how to make a feature from her mistakes. And I really like that. And I think this precept kind of points to that in the respect that we're all going to make mistakes. Like, mistakes are not the major issue. Like, it's the next thing, right? Maybe the feeling of like, oh, I'm an idiot for doing this, or like, I'm not worthy of love, or like, I'm a moron, or something like that. This kind of thinking after the mistake. The mistake itself is just a mistake. It's just part of being a human being, you know? When I looked into the language of this precept in this temple, I noticed that, like, when I looked at all other organizations and other temples, the language favored more, like, it points towards, like, other people's mistakes. And our language is really neutral, right? It's like, do not dwell on past mistakes. It's not leading you to whether these mistakes are other people or whether it's your own mistakes. I've always read it as my mistakes, because my mistakes are, like, super loud. Like, I can remember all my mistakes, you know? And, I can remember mistakes from 20, like, I can't remember where I left my keys last night, but I can remember mistakes from like 20 years ago. I can remember all my mistakes. Other people's mistakes don't really have the same kind of, like, energy around them for me. You know, my mistakes are like, feel big, like, and they've got like energy. The first number of retreats I did, you know, sat in silence there for a week or 5 or 6 or 7 days. I had a lot of like dwelling on mistakes. This was like a thing for me for quite a while. There's just a lot of energy around it, and especially like mistakes around like relationships and like and loved ones, like, you know, things that like broken relationships or whatever, like that those kind of mistakes, like, there's a lot of like circular thought and a lot of like stories behind it, and the stories are like the key bit for me, you know, like the stories that kind of reinforce it, like give it kind of energy, you know. And those are the interesting, like, the stories we build behind mistakes. That's like really informative, that in your practice. A lot of ruminating on fault finding, definitely. Sometimes, like, when I was in that rumination about my mistakes, like there's a clue to like something that's undone and something that needs to be done about a mistake. And sometimes you can do something about a mistake. But often there's nothing to be done. And then you're left with you're left with some powerful things, but then you're left with like forgiveness and contrition and compassion for yourself and for others too. But like mostly compassion for yourself, because it's like, it's hard, and we're making mistakes all the time, you know? Part of being human is making mistakes. That's kind of the deal. So So we're going to make mistakes. Like, let's just accept that we're going to make mistakes, right? And we're going to fail. And but let's also understand that we might be able to make, hopefully, make features out of our mistakes, right? We can hopefully like learn something, or we could make it something better. So that's what I have to say about making mistakes. So is there any questions about this precept about making mistakes? Is there anybody that, is there something I missed out about making mistakes here in this precept? Is there anybody here that has something to share about mistakes, or somebody that doesn't make mistakes? That would be really interesting. I really want to meet somebody who doesn't want to make mistakes.
This is Ed. You said something I really appreciated. I've read or repeated this hundreds of times at least, and it never occurred to me until just now that this could be referring to other people's mistakes rather than my own. And that really adds a whole different dimension. And I went back and I reread it and I'm like, oh, dude, okay.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah, that's really enlightening, isn't it, that you jumped to that. Thank you.
Hi, this is Allison. I actually had thought about that exact question of whose mistakes are these quite a bit, because the first time I read this, it felt so distant and divorced from kind of most of what I've read about all major religions that generally don't talk about not blaming yourself for stuff. And when I read it, I thought this is about grace versus revenge when somebody has wronged you, which is, I feel like, a topic, what do you do when someone wrongs you, that many religions spend a lot of time thinking about. But I feel more recently, as I've read it, I've started to think about the questions that we ask today a lot about how much should we dwell on kind of historical mistakes, and whether we should dwell on them and how we should deal with them, whether we learn from them, and all the things wrapped up in how we should think about kind of big historical mistakes, which feels very complicated.
I agree. That is very complicated. Thank you.
I have a question about the commentary verses. And in particular, in the Buddha Dharma, there is one path, one Dharma, one realization, one practice. For instance, when I think about the steel one, and then it says, no thought of gain is this precept. I make sense of that. But having, there is one path, one, I don't know what to make of that. I'm wondering if you could just say something about that. Hey, from what your comments were before, I would almost expect, don't worry, there's many paths, there's many realizations, you know, and this is, no, there's one.
Well,
and just say something about this. I don't know what to make of this.
Okay, so I think, there's something about being involved in, so being, dwelling in mistakes that is taking us away from the present moment, right? It's taking us away from now. Like there's an involvement in not now, right? And I think this is pointing to like, there's now, like get back to now, get out of your head.
Thanks.
Hi. I'm wondering, when you don't dwell on past mistakes, what is it when it's not a mistake anymore? If you're not, is it just a thing that happened?
Well, it could be something to learn from, couldn't it? I mean, it could be something that happened. What is a mistake?
Well, off of what was like just kind of said, I was thinking well, maybe mistakes are like all the possible or alternate reality interpretations of the thing that happened. And then when you are like, meh, not a mistake anymore, or like just thing that happened, then all of like the mistake qualities of all the alternate interpretations of reality close, and you just got the one path or like one realization, and then it becomes like the thing that happened.
I think the dwelling is the problem, not the mistake, right? It's the next thing.
It's still a mistake.
Well, I guess it is a mistake, yeah. Like, we don't, I mean, but the dwelling is the problem. So can mistakes not be a problem?
I don't know. Like, maybe the mistake is like, isn't as much of a mistake as you thought it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or like, maybe it's like a much bigger deal, but thinking of it as like cataclysmic makes it like non-actionable.
There's also, have you ever had that situation where something looks like a mistake, but later on with more perspective and more time, it's actually the incident is the same, but the result has changed? It's now neutral, or it could turn out to be a good thing. Is a mistake still a mistake if a good thing happens?
I don't know. I don't know what a mistake is anymore.
Good, you're on the right path.
Can someone tell me what a mistake is?
Okay, here we go. Is it time? Is that what we're doing? Okay.
Okay, adding something there.
Yeah. Please. So,
let me just weigh in on mistakes a wee bit here. Yeah, I think Minshew's on that. It's not so much like, it's not as interesting a question like how mistakey a mistake is, like its ontological value, like whatever. Like it's different. It like we can see it from different perspectives, as Minshew's pointed out, from different times. It's going to look different. But we don't have a whole lot of control over that. We do have a lot of control over like how I relate to it, and so that dwelling is sort of a clue. And I think it counts for like the question about historical generational mistakes that have happened. Like we want to learn from them. We want to like speak to them. We want to understand. But we don't want to like perseverate, you know, we don't want to like just get stuck in like mired in that mistake. We want to like, you know, bring clarity to it and, you know, have a sense of cleanness there.
Hi.
Hi, this is Caitlin. I am very curious about the sentence, "Do not condone haphazard talk." Because I think that all this talk about dwelling and allowing mistakes to exist, and that one seems like more active or more sort of like something to not tolerate. And I'm curious about the relationship of that sentence to the rest of it.
So this bit, do not engage in fault finding, do not condone haphazard talk. For me, this is more about like when we engage, for me, I see this as like we're engaging in other people's faults and having adding things to it and getting something from it. Like if this is happening, what I'm noticing in myself is kind of like an elevation of myself, like thinking like, this person is terrible at this, but I'm kind of like, well, I'm great at that. Like I'm a good person, you know what I mean? And so condoning the haphazard talk, I think is also like, is not affirming that when you come across these conversations, recognizing that this is not skillful, you know? And so like, look out for that kind of talk and like, no, I'm not engaging in that, you know what I mean? That's what it says to me anyway.
That's really helpful. And I realize that possibly some of my confusion is because I also read it as only being able to refer to my own mistakes rather than being superior over other people's mistakes, but it makes a lot more sense. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so we're quickly going to, you know the drill right now. We're going to get into, scan this room right now and see if you can find one person or a couple of people that you haven't shared with recently. And I've got a question for you all when you get in small groups of three. So please find a group of three. Okay, here's your question. I love that you're all being very chatty and introducing yourself to one another. That's very nice. Okay, so in the realm of the flawless Dharma, not expounding upon error is the precept of not dwelling on past mistakes. So we learn from mistakes, okay? So where's that line between, for you, where's that line between learning from a mistake and dwelling on a mistake? Like, where is that? When is that too much? When? Okay, thank you.
All righty. I think we're going to move on to the next one, which is, do not praise self or blame others. Maintain modesty, extol virtue. In the realm of the equitable Dharma, not dwelling upon I versus you is the precept of not praising self or blaming others. All Buddhas and ancestors realize the empty sky and the great earth. When they manifest the noble body, there is neither inside nor outside in emptiness. When they manifest the Dharma body, not even a speck of dust is seen upon the ground. So these two precepts that we're looking at tonight have a fair amount in common. They're both pretty relational. They're both about like who we are in the realm of other human beings. Not exclusively, but that's prominent often in how these precepts are held. Similar to the do not dwell on past mistakes, there's a me, you, like kind of flip-flop that happens here. Like it's do not praise self or blame others. It can also be do not blame self and praise others. Like that's equally valid. The subject, like, you know, we're looking at the activity, right? Like where that activity is directed is part of it, but the precept is really like, you know, when that's happening. Yeah. And you know, with that blame and praise, often they're found together, right? Like if one is present, and typically one's loud and the other is a little more subtle. But it's a useful exercise to try to notice both, because it kind of distributes like the weight balance a little bit more. Pride and shame like fit right in with, you know, praise and blame. If one is present, the other is also probably present somewhere in the situation. And just kind of noting, like, okay, like scanning my experience, like it may be really obvious to me how like pride is present. Like, what am I covering up, right? Like, why am I puffing up? Like, what's the fear underneath, right? Because that's just, it gives me a clearer picture. So likewise, if I'm feeling judgmental, like, what's that counterpoint that's a little more subtle, that's a little hidden somehow? Often it's a pride piece. Often it's something where I'm, you know, puffing up in some way. So check that out as a possible tool for working with this precept, looking at the opposites. Another thing that has been useful for me in working with this precept is like when I first kind of like realize I'm in this territory, often there's a fairly like obvious like relation that matters. It's how I'm seen by this person or something that that person did that I'm noticing, right? There's something, there's a fairly like tight mandala. And that's wildly unrealistic. It's just what I'm noticing is like, that's the loud part. And to try to like, oh yeah, like who else is affected? Who else has awareness of this? Like to just expand the situation, because then all the weight's not on that one interaction. All the weight's not on that one relationship, right? It distributes it. I would say it sounds like that might be a little bit of a mental exercise, but like there's a pretty significant somatic effect if you do it, right? Like that sense of like distribution and like softening of energy is really palpable. So if you run into this one, check it out. One thing, so like the last one ended with the not condone haphazard talk, right? Pretty explicit, like, okay, that's a directive. This one ends with, when they manifest the Dharma body, not even a speck of dust is seen upon the ground. So it's a little more poetic, a little harder to grasp, perhaps. What I want to, like, with all of the precepts, another tool that we use is like switching the, again, adjusting perception, but like what's useful to be attending to here? So there's an absolute perspective, there's a relative perspective. There are times when we really want to like, you know, a red light means stop, right? And there are times when that's useful, where that kind of dualistic conditioned view is like very helpful. And if we're relying on that exclusively, it's a very narrow band of perception, right? It's a very limited access to meaning. And it's very easy to kind of perpetuate this sense of self, which is really quite painful. So checking to see, like, do I need to be in this? Do I need to use the relative perception right now? Or could I stretch? Could I, like, access the bigger mind right now? How does this look? And I think that's part of what this commentary is speaking to in the realm of the equitable Dharma. So that word, you know, the previous one was flawless Dharma, where we don't see error. Equitable, where we're not seeing self and other. Not dwelling upon I versus you is a precept of not praising self or blaming others. In a big view, we have it, right? In a big view, there's no lack. There's the empty sky and the great earth, right? It's a really vast place. And so there's no speck of dust with that mind. One of the words that will come up during the Jukai session is immaculacy. Genko spoke to that a little bit in her Dharma talk a couple of weeks ago. But just that absence of error. And so it's true, like we all make plenty of errors, and there's plenty of blame to strew around because we're all making errors. And sometimes it's important to note that, right? We want to have a clear view of the world, and we don't want to get like stuck in that. We want to like refresh with enough frequency that we do have this equanimity, that we're And we touch this realm of the equitable Dharma. Okay. Questions or comments so far? Yeah, Julia. Extol to speak about how great it is. Yeah. All right, Reju, to your left. Yes.
The line, all Buddhas and ancestors realize the empty sky and the great earth. Like ever since the first time I read the Kyoji Kaimon, that really stuck out to me. And when I took the precepts, Jukai was my first sesshin, and I remember laying out in the savannah, like on the great earth, gazing at the empty sky, and it just really landed. Like the somatic sense of what that was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when we're really at home in ourself, like there's no need to compare, right? It doesn't make sense. It's extra. It's like wildly extra. And that's part of what this precept is speaking to. All right. So there's in the relative world, like people do make mistakes. We do have to assess, like, you know, merits and flaws and whether situations work for us and or not. And we want to be able to see with clarity, see with equanimity. And so there's a little bit of tension there between not praising self and blaming others or blaming self and praising others, right? This comparison. And also, like, what is? And there is difference in the world. There is gradient. There's a lot of differentiation. And so we want to be able to speak to that with honesty, with authenticity, without getting caught in this sense of separation. So how do people work with that? I feel like that's like the koan of this precept. What have you noticed? Those who have played with this before, or everyone's played with this before because you're alive and in here.
Thank you. That's a really live koan for me often. So I'm going to think out loud. And yeah, sometimes it's felt really important to make those distinctions and to get clear about kind of what's working for me or what's not. And other times I've really done a lot of like focusing on the seeds of wholesomeness in my thinking and in my speech and just choosing to not indulge that kind of difference making. And so I feel like I'm often kind of exploring that territory. So if something's like a recurring pattern, I might experiment with kind of exploring some of that differentiation, but then going back like into a, I really don't want to feed that mind state. So I'm going to just, I'm going to really land in the larger perspective and not let that kind of take root because I know what those effects are and they're usually unwholesome. But it's definitely a live koan for me. Thanks for bringing that up.
You made me think of relationally in the world of work when we're working with a group of people. And I really value different ways of being and thinking. We have different makeups. But there can be a tension between, quote unquote, getting things done mm-hmm. when there's very different communication styles. Mm-hmm. And so I find it really, it's something I'm really aware of and I try to observe. Where's the point where there's too much out of bounds that's not helping
reach what the group is trying to accomplish. Mm-hmm. So I find that that's where it's really rich. One-on-one, I find it easier to work with, but once it's four or five people and they're four or five people who have very different ways of communicating, I always wonder, should we be doing something different? Would that squash somebody's spirit? You know, that's how it comes for me.
Not so much anymore, but like it used to be a really useful check for myself is to kind of give myself the little like test, like, do I want people to be more like me, like in this interaction? And if so, like cease and desist, right? If I can catch myself doing it, like, because I know it's wrong. I know I don't actually want that. I just think I want that because I think it would be easier, but it's wildly inaccurate, but I fool myself. And so I check for it. Yeah.
I really like the contrast between the first sentence and then the rest of it. And I see it as a little bit referring to the whole praise and blame game, which for me always sounds like prizes and awards and grades and kind of all of the various ways we, you know, praise people and fame. Blame is harder, but similar, I guess, in some ways. And then the whole second paragraph or whatever, you know, makes me think of when you take a road trip in the West and you're like standing in the emptiness of like Death Valley or whatever, and it's huge and all of that seems absurdly silly. And it's not that, you know, that award wasn't merited or somebody didn't do something wrong, but versus the enormousness of the empty sky over Death Valley, that is all so pointless and not worth being excited about. So it's not that it's not there, it's just kind of perspective. Mm-hmm. That's how I read that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good example. Thank you.
I noticed that I am most grumpy when I think that something has gotten in the way of me connecting with someone else, or like I just like underneath the blame or even like the praising self is like a desire to like be like in connection with everyone. And somehow that gets construed into like, you've gotten in my way of connecting with you. Which like when I kind of realize that, I'm like, oh wait, probably some of this was like largely circumstantial and it has like probably limited things to do with like either of us at all. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Then it's like, okay, not the blaming others. It's just like, I'm back in connection then.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I want to like pull out about that anecdote or story or whatever is, like we do have these like specific ways in which this manifests for us, like the like just easy places to feel it. And if you get to know those well, like, you get to know the escape hatch, right? And so like that's part of what I'm hearing in that is like, all right, like you get familiar with that particular illusion and that's the route to dispelling it. Yeah. Time for maybe one or two more.
Hi. So I guess I am curious of the aspect of, because I don't want to dwell on past mistakes. I don't want to praise self or blame others, but I get mad when someone does something and like, and I know I need to let go of it to move on and like be happy and content with myself. But then there's like an element of like justice that needs to happen. And I don't know if that's true, but like, that's an aspect that I want to consider. And I'm curious what your take on justice is.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think probably we all have a feeling about that, right? Like we all sort of recognize like fair versus not fair. Like there's a basic visceral sense of like something's recognizable there. So, sure. And, you know, like if you've been around a variety of people, you'll notice that people's ideas of what's right don't always align. And certainly, like in terms of like, you know, how justice might be applied skillfully, like certainly doesn't align. So I want to just approach that with a lot of humility. Like I have my conditioning, I have my life experiences. I want to own that and like, just be really careful about that whole justice thing, because I think that's a bigger question. Like, I trust that, like, you know, cause and effect just kind of like karma happens, and I don't mean that in kind of like a like super superstitious metaphysical way. I just mean like there's way more effect than we can track, and basically I trust that. Like it's not my job to enforce that. Like I'm gonna, like, my sphere of influence is not that great, and I'm gonna steer towards like not suffering so much. And I feel like that is pretty useful to the world. I feel like I'm having a pretty significant impact by doing that consistently over time, and much more impact than I would have if I was trying to police the whole like justice situation.
Great, thank you for your answer.
Yeah. That was kind of a long answer, but it was a complicated question. Jitsuso has one, and I think we'll wrap it up there.
This is Jitsuso. Justice, this is all about justice. But 15 years ago, I had the experience of...
Oh, dicey start.
15 years ago, I had the experience of being picked to serve on a Multnomah County grand jury. If most people don't really understand what a grand jury is, it's not a trial. It's a panel of people who are asked to review evidence selected by the district attorney to decide, will the people move forward with case against an individual, and it's up to the grand jurors to decide. And it's generally a rubber stamp, because if the district attorney has done their job, they don't waste the grand jurors' time, which is limited. They only come to you and say, we have this evidence against this individual, and it's not an adversarial kind of procedure. So you get the situation where every day for a month, we'd hear these cases, and then it's like, okay, it's basically a rubber stamp. And you get really kind of jaded after a while. Start to think, well, they wouldn't be here. They wouldn't be talking about John or Jane Doe unless they were actually guilty. Until you get presented a case where it's actually really questionable and some really bad judgments have been made about even bringing the case forward. And that happens. not often, but it does happen. But it was real interesting to see the dynamics of the people, because you get to the situation where people want to say, oh, well, it's automatic. Until that one case comes up where it's clearly something is amiss and they should have never considered charging a person. And then it becomes, oh, well, it's up to us to somehow fix the system. And so we kind of flip back and forth between this kind of sanctimony and, you know, are we going to do our job? What are the past mistakes here that we're dealing with? What are we bringing to it from our own situations, our own history? So anyway, it's just it was a really interesting situation. I don't have a solution, but it was a really interesting experience.
Sounds like a lot of fodder for exploring these precepts. All right.